But first, I'd like to say hello to you for the second part of the symposium on the remaining disorders of the group of... are you here? Sorry. The remaining part of the stress and trauma-related disorders. Are you here as a technician? Or?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Could you be so kind and ask for... Pardon me? This is very nice. As I told you, we got two changes, or actually three changes in our agenda for the second part. Two changes are because two speakers were not able to come here. And the third one is that our discussant, Mark van Ommeren, who works at WHO, would love to be here but is not able to be here. And therefore, we may get, and I promise you, we get more time to for a discussion. But now, if time is running out, I may begin here with my presentation. I got my MacBook here, and it works on my MacBook, but it's not able to open here. My presentation is on the philosophy and the... creation of the next version of the ICD-11 proposal. And I wanted first to show you that the group is a truly international one. One slide shows that our 10 core members are from all around the world, and that we have people from Asia, from Africa, from other parts as well, and in addition, we got some people working with us from organizations like the Médecins Sans Frontières or the International Red Cross and the International Medical Corps. These are all together the members of our working group representing a truly international panel. Next, I wanted to repeat what Michael was already presenting to you, the WHO constituencies, meaning that the goal of the whole process is, because of the truly international one, the member countries of WHO are the stakeholders of the whole process. And another kind of stakeholders are the mental health professionals. And not only psychiatrists work with classifications like ICD, but also, of course, psychologists, social workers, and other frontline practitioners. And last but not least, service users, meaning our clients, meaning the patients, are to be related to the process of developing a new ICD-11. My next slide, imaginary here, would have shown again that the first main goal of the of our process is to reduce the disease burden of mental and behavioral disorders. And you know, the representatives from the international organization, at least them, or the representatives from other parts in the world, are often apply what we are developing to crisis situations worldwide, be it crises from natural catastrophes or man-made and war-stricken areas. And with all decisions we have, for example, getting rid of the subtypes, we have in our eyes to, if it's applicable at front line with all the various professions. The focus on clinical utility has been highlighted before, and I only like to mention it again and again. Clinical utility, including simplicity, is a very high goal for us. And last but not least, WHO takes it very, very seriously to have independence from pharmaceutical and other commercial influences. It's an extremely high priority. I know that DSM tries to secure it as well, but for us it's really constitutional. Key characteristic of revision processes are it has to be global, it has to be multilingual, and I'm really sorry to only show you by three of our members, including me, by Eurico, who will present next, and Cecile, that we are non-English-speaking members in our group. And as I already told you, we had Asma, who is not here, would represent at least one not non-English-speaking country. Multidisciplinary. I'd like to highlight that in the history of ICD mental health chapters development, only psychiatrists took the lead of being chair of one of the chapters. In my person, for example, the first psychologist is leading a group for reconstruction or of developing the ICD-11. In the future, it may well be that social workers will be chair of one of the working groups of ICD-12. It's transparent. It has to be a very transparent process. And as I already mentioned, independent of conflicts of interests. The multilingual development of ICD-11 is very important. And, you know, it, as already mentioned, the next step very soon of the field trials will be truly multilingual because we have to translate very soon all of our criteria into the main languages. And I got a slide, but it looks like we will not have the chance to get it work, to show you that in Brazil and India and what else, some other countries who are not English-speaking, at least Brazil, and Spanish-speaking countries, we will have our field trials, meaning that we have to translate it into Brazilian Portuguese and Spanish and Chinese, not to forget China, mainland China and other Chinese regions in the world. The collection of evidence of clinical utility is probably similar to what DSM is doing, but in our case, because of the lack of data in developing countries or mid-developed countries, we of course rely on clinical expertise and cannot claim and do not want to claim that's all hardcore empirical evidence expressed in data sets published in highly ranked journals. I then wanted to get to preparatory survey. The survey was done by the ICD mental health chapter crew of WHO, namely Jeffrey Reed and Mark van Ommeren and Anne Watts from South Africa, and they asked practitioners for the use of most used diagnosis across ICD-10, the old one. And I wanted to show you that two of the disorders of our group are amongst the most popular or the most often used, frequent used disorders, namely adjustment disorders and PTSD. And there are convincing data. World Psychiatry already published it on the psychiatrist survey, and it's very interesting probably for you to look into it. PTSD was the seventh most used disorder category worldwide, and adjustment disorder the ninth most used category worldwide. And with the psychologists, the publication is still in preparation or in press with the main psychology journal. It's a reversed order. Psychologists tend to diagnose adjustment disorder very, very frequent in their daily practice, and then PTSD comes very close. They are both in the top 10 categories of all 200 and something psychiatric disorders. So, I'd like to shorten my part up because of the lacking support of my PowerPoints. I only like to name you when we began our work, not too long ago. Thank you. I think now I'm almost done. Thank you. I hoped you would be earlier here, but okay. 1 year ago, we began our work, and we did a literature search, and we found in PubMed, as you may imagine, that PTSD has a lot of studies in it, more than 5,000. Adjustment disorders actually had 290, acute stress reaction 230, and the enduring personality change after catastrophic experiences, which we now tend to call or complex PTSD, only had 13. I'd like to add one sentence to what Marilyn said in the first part of our symposium. In other parts of the world, these ICD diagnosis F62, enduring personality change, has been used frequently for expert witnesses and for juridical terms. It's not in the scientific literature, but it has been extensively used, and we have to care for it. Prolonged grief disorder came next with over 210 publications, and we also checked developmental trauma disorders. But this very interesting construct had only 1 year ago 3 entrances in PubMed. So I wanted to show again, like Michael first did, our invitation to participate in the field trial. And I would have done the same like you, Michael, show you the email address of Spencer Evans. It's Evans with a double S at w.international, or I can't read my own. INT, international. But now I got 30 copies of a leaflet here, and I'd like to share it with you with some more information about this beginning field trial. If you are interested, please then come here. I will give the 30 copies from here. That is what I wanted to tell you with a lot of more text and illustration and some graphics, sorry. And now I'd like to ask the next speaker. And the next speaker, if I remember it right, are you, Yuriko. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Andreas, for a kind introduction. And This is the disclaimer. I have no commercial relationship to disclose. And then I will talk about acute stress reaction, but this is my personal view, although I'm in the I'm the member of the working group. And so I will talk about a major conceptual change of acute stress reaction. I think it's going to be another controversial issue in the revision. And I will talk about a current definition of acute stress reaction, ASR, in ICD-10 and problem around it. And then proposed definition of acute stress reaction in ICD-11. And then some other some issues we had in this revision. Is it a pathological or normal reaction, and time frame issue, and differential diagnosis? So a current definition of acute stress reaction in ICD-10 is this disorder or reaction happen following exposure to extreme stressor with immediate onset with limit within 1 hour. This is a definition. And with a variety of symptoms, and it describes Fugue, daze, and dissociation is described as a typical symptom of ASR. And if the stressor is transient or can be relieved, it diminishes within 8 hours. And then also there is a time frame of 48 hours by definition. And so, and then this is also the synonymous include acute crisis reaction and combat fatigue. And so, but traditionally, historically, this category, this definition was derived from military setting. But a problem around this definition is as we have gained more work in crisis situation, especially among the civilians in disaster or accident, we realize that the transient reaction is a normative immediate reaction in some people in exceptional stress. And also we realize that a need for non-pathological category so that we can identify those in need, people in need, without pathologizing the reactions. But with the current definition, clinical utility is very limited because of the narrow time frame. And people who will recover naturally within few days will not seek medical help. So we do not have much evidence base on acute stress reaction with current definition. And so also there is a confusion between acute stress reaction in ICD and also acute stress disorder in DSM system. Acute stress reaction is for management of acute reaction which caused by various stressor, not necessarily traumatic stress. And with a duration of 48 hours, and we can anticipate natural recovery in due course. And so this, and since this is a reaction, not disorder, so the functional impairment is not mentioned in the definition. And on the other hand, acute stress disorder in DSM was originally defined to promote early detection and intervention of PTSD. However, with the review of extensive research on acute stress disorder, we now have a doubt that ASD is a good predictor of later later development of PTSD. And so our proposed definition of ASR in ICD-11 is a transient normative reaction given the severity of stressor, and it has a clear and direct temporal association between the stressor and reaction. And such event include natural disaster, accident, like major events, and also the sudden or threatening a major change in social or personal relationship, personal incident. And in terms of symptom of ASR in the revision, is it has variety of symptom, but we don't put emphasis on like fugue or daze as a characteristic central feature of ASR. And also it has autonomic sign as well. And symptoms usually appear within hours to days, and it will diminish or it will decrease within a week. So this is a new definition in terms of time frame. And people with ASR recover within typically like 4 weeks if the stress is ceasing. In developing this proposal, we had a discussion regarding if it is this really pathological or normal reaction. So in the world of ICD-10, it should be put in F code or Z code. And then we decided to propose ASR to be in Z code, normal reaction. And with that change, we can send the message that this reaction is normative and a common reaction, but not universal. And with this change, we will have opportunity to train health worker, not necessarily mental health professional, but more broadly health workers, to recognize this normal reaction without pathologizing these reactions. And such reaction, and these acute stress reaction often benefit from practical social intervention rather than medical one. For example, psychological first aid is a common approach in time of disaster, and it says psychological, but it doesn't mean it is not really about psychological help, but practical help. And the other issue was we discussed was time frame issue. So this is like a recapture of our definition. The symptoms appear within hours or day of the impact of the stressor, and it begin to decrease within a week after the exposure. And where the stressor continue or cannot be removed, so the symptom may persist. But normally, I mean, typically, it will decrease within about a month. So this is our proposed definition. And then with this definition, with this time frame, will help to distinguish acute stress reaction from pathological one, and that may predict more severe disorder. And in the course of the observation, if symptoms do not begin to decrease within about a week after the onset, we should consider possibility of developing mental disorder, for example, adjustment disorder or PTSD. And so here are some candidates for differential diagnosis of acute stress reaction. One is a PTSD, which can be differentiated by reaction which persists beyond several weeks and characterized by the three core symptoms of re-experiencing or avoidance or hyperarousal, and it should have functional impairment by definition. And second diagnosis would be like adjustment disorder, and usually these relate to stressor of lesser severity than that of acute stress reaction. And then it would have a symptom of ongoing preoccupation to the stressor or failure to adapt symptom, and it will be discussed later in this session. And dissociative disorder, which in which dissociative symptom would persist for longer term, and then the main feature would be amnesia, fugue, and stupor. So in summary, acute stress reaction will be situated in Z-code as a normal reaction to make it clear that this transient reaction is normative and immediate reaction in some people who experience extreme stress. And with the proposal of this ASR, there is a departure from ASD in DSM-5 because the research shows that ASD we have doubt about the utility of ASR as a predictor of future PTSD. And the longer time frame will help to distinguish acute stress reaction from more pathological reactions such as PTSD or adjustment disorder. But more evidence on this proposed definition and utility in relation to practical service is needed for further re-examination. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Yuriko. I'm glad we get time left for discussion for this proposal. And as you already mentioned, Yuriko, it may be a reason for an origin for other controversy as well. So now the next presentation is on prolonged grief disorder. And as two times announced, our presenter is... the author is not here, but Marilyn Cloutre is so kind to read the presentation. And now the technicians tried to create new problems, and the presentation is here it is. Oops, sorry, but it's not able to open. In this case, it would be a disaster. Thank you.
sir. Okay. Well, I'm speaking for the subgroup that worked on prolonged grief disorder, Ashraf Kagi from South Africa, Richard Bryant from Australia, and Lynn Jones from the U.S. Prolonged grief disorder is being proposed as a new category, and it's a disorder specifically associated with a stressor, that is, the death of a loved one. The overall definition is essentially the experience after 6 months following the death of a loved one of a pervasive yearning or longing for the deceased. Symptoms may also include difficulty in accepting the death, feeling that one has lost a part of oneself, and that lastly, the grief response is beyond the expected social or cultural norms and also causes significant functional impairment. This is, again, a more detailed approach in terms of the diagnostic guidelines. Separation distress that is characterized by yearning or longing for the deceased, associated with emotional pain or persistent preoccupation. And this theory comes from attachment. This diagnosis comes from attachment theory, so you can imagine some of these symptoms being the searching for the person, the preoccupation for the person, and separation distress. Other aspects of the disorder may also be a feeling of bitterness about the loss, difficulty accepting, a reduced sense of self or identity, and avoidance of reminders of the loss. Additional characteristics may be inability to trust people, difficulty progressing with activities or developing friendships, feeling that life is meaningless. In addition, numbness, negative appraisals of one's ability to cope without the loved ones, and patients may oscillate between excessive preoccupation with the deceased and avoidance of reminders of the deceased. Again, sort of the attachment picture of the disorganized attachment. The severity of the response must persist for at least 6 months following the death. More of the same, interfere with normal functioning and beyond normative response with cultural context. Risk factors for this disorder that have actually, I think, been supported by research: a history of childhood separation anxiety, controlling parents, parental abuse or parental death, I assume in early life, a close kinship relationship to the deceased, such as one's parents, insecure attachment styles, dependency on the deceased, lack of preparation for the death, inability to perform appropriate funeral rites, and absence of a body. Other basis for specification of this disorder is that the constellation of symptoms have been observed to form a syndrome, internal consistency of the symptoms, that these internally consistent symptoms are distinct from depression and anxiety, and that the construct has been observed across cultures. Other basis for specification is that the symptoms of prolonged grief disorder is not responsive to pharmacological or psychological treatments for depression. They are responsive, however, to psychological treatments that specifically target the symptoms of prolonged grief disorder. In terms of differential diagnosis, prolonged grief disorder can be distinguished from major depressive disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder, where in major depressive disorder, there is a pervasive sad mood, while in PGD, the sadness is specifically related to the missing of the deceased. Major depression, pervasive sense of guilt as compared to guilt focused on interactions with the deceased. Ruminations about past failures or misdeed in major depression. In PGD is preoccupation with positive thoughts of the deceased or intrusive images of the person dying or avoidance of situations and people related to reminders of the loss. How is PGD different from PTSD? In PTSD, there is a trigger by a physical threat here. There's a trigger by a loss. In PTSD, the primary emotion is fear. In PGD, primary emotion is sadness. In PTSD, of course, nightmares are common, and painful reminders are linked to the traumatic event, while in PGD, nightmares are rare, and painful reminders are more pervasive and unexpected, and there's again the yearning and longing for the person who has died. The difference between, quote, normal bereavement and PGD is the persistence of the symptoms in a way that is significantly distressing and impacts functioning for more than 6 months. Developmental presentations in children, the loss of the primary attachment figure can be perceived as traumatic and may lead to distressing memories or fantasies of the deceased. Yearning may be expressed in play and other behaviors that involve separation themes. Cultural-related features, key in this disorder, is the need to recognize culturally appropriate norms of grieving and that there is not an interpretation made of prolonged behaviors related to grieving as abnormal if they are part of the cultural norm. There is a flag, however, if a person is unable to perform or participate in typical culturally sensitive, culturally specific rituals or ceremonies, and that these in turn are predictive of and can lead to prolonged grief. And lastly, the absence of bodies in some cultures, I don't know, all cultures, I would think. To perform last rites or lack of closure due to uncertain death, such as after disappearance, can lead to prolonged grief. Comparison with DSM-5 and ICD-11, if there is persistent symptoms beyond 6 months of the death, that is when a diagnosis would become available. In DSM-5, that time duration is extended to 12 months. And I think that is that. I am so sorry that Kaji and various others are not here. Just reporting what they were going to present.
Thank you. And the same procedure by reading. Hopefully we get it technically done. So the next presentation on adjustment disorders will be by Chris Bruin, kindly. And we then would have enough time, I guess, for discussing the content of the current symposium and, in case you are interested, also the content of the previous symposium.
Grief disorder.
Oops, sorry.
Yeah, that's not the right part. That's not a real PowerPoint file. That's a temporary file.
Here, I got it here.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
In here.
That won't open. Mm-hmm. There it is.
Good. So, last condition we'll be talking about is adjustment disorder. And again, you will not be disappointed to learn there are a few changes which will introduce some interesting differences with the DSM-5. I know you'd really let down if we told you that it's going to be exactly the same as DSM-5, but we can offer you something different. So as Andreas mentioned earlier on this afternoon, adjustment disorder is among the most widely used diagnoses among psychiatrists worldwide. But there have been a number of concerns expressed. First of all, because adjustment disorder is rather ill-defined, is often described as the wastebasket of the psychiatric classification system, and the required presence of the preceding events and the thematic links between the events and the symptoms is really not spelled out in any great detail. And adjustment disorder has mostly been used as a residual category for patients who do not meet the diagnostic criteria for depressive or anxiety disorders, or as a provisional diagnosis when it is not clear whether or not a post-traumatic or mood disorder will emerge. So the main points of the proposals involve, first of all, using an evidence-based framework to link adjustment disorders as part of the spectrum of stress responses, i.e., from normal adaptation to more complex pathological responses to stressful events. So the role of the stressor will be described. That we will outline specific criteria based on the stress response literature without restricting clinical use. We're going to review the clinical utility of the subtypes which are present in DSM-5 and define bereavement-related presentations as a separate category, so it would now be excluded from adjustment disorders. So first of all, something about the role of the stressor. Adjustment disorders are described in continuity with normal adaptation processes, but differentiated from them by the intensity of distress and impairment. And it's seen as a transient disorder, which usually emerges within 1 month of the stressor and tends to resolve in 6 months unless the stressor persists for a longer duration. The severity of the stressor is not a consideration for diagnosis, but adjustment disorder may result from extreme traumatic events when symptoms do not meet the criteria for PTSD. And the presentation of adjustment disorders might be influenced by the nature of the stressor event. For example, whether it's a single, repeated, cumulative, or long-term events, and also might be affected by previous experiences. So we're proposing new specific criteria based on the stress response literature, and that adjustment disorders are characterized by symptoms, first of all, of preoccupation. And these would include excessive worry, recurrent and distressing thoughts, or constant rumination. The distress tends to worsen with reminders of the stressor, and the person often avoids stimuli, thoughts, feelings, or discussions associated with it. And secondly, there's a failure to adapt with loss of interest in work, social life, caring for others, or leisure activities. And the individual might have difficulty in concentrating, sleeping, or engaging in familiar activities. There's another. The range of clinical presentations is recognized as being very broad. It includes such things as anxiety, depression, impulse control problems, substance abuse. But none of these additional symptoms must be of sufficient severity or prominence in their own right to justify a more specific diagnosis. When it comes to subtypes, the working group felt there was no evidence for the clinical utility of the subtypes in ICD-10, that the characteristic features of adjustment disorders were often an unspecified mixture of emotional and behavioral symptoms, and that simply trying to specify a number of different subtypes added unnecessarily to the complexity of the diagnostic system and did not actually bias very much. So it was noted, for example, that although internalizing and externalizing symptoms may predominate, they often coexist, and that introducing subtypes might place too much emphasis on the dominant idiom of distress and might be partially misleading, particularly taking different cultural considerations into account. So the view was that subtypes are not helpful either in terms of the treatment selected or in terms of prognosis, and that therefore the proposal is to eliminate subtypes from adjustment disorders. So to summarize the definition, Adjustment disorder is a maladaptive reaction to identifiable psychosocial stressors or life changes. It's characterized by preoccupation with the stressor and failure to adapt, as exhibited by a range of symptoms interfering with everyday functioning. A variety of symptoms are commonly present. They emerge within a month of the onset of the stressor and tend to resolve in 6 months unless the stressor persists for longer. It causes significant distress and impairment of social or occupational functioning. And the last slide just summarizes the differences between adjustment disorders in ICD-11 and DSM-5. So in ICD-11, there is a more specific criteria that count the disorder into making it an adjustment disorder rather than exclusion criteria. There are no subtypes, unlike in DSM-5. Symptoms appear within a month as opposed to within 3 months in DSM-5. Distress and impairment is necessary in ICD-11, but distress and or impairment is necessary in DSM-5. And finally, bereavement-related disorders, as you've seen from the last presentation, is in a separate category, whereas the current proposals within DSM-5, although they're still changing a bit as we speak, is that bereavement should be included in this category. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chris, for reading this presentation. And now, time is left for discussion. Much time is left for discussion. Who wants to comment on either content of this or the previous symposium? Yes, please. Or could you please go to the microphone? That would be great.
In the presentation about acute stress response in the differentiating characteristic between acute stress response and acute stress disorder, you mentioned that the event for acute stress response is more severe? No? What was it that you said about the quality of the event that's different between the two?
For the acute stress disorder in DSM, it's after the traumatic events. But for acute stress reaction, it's not necessarily traumatic events, but more broader stressor.
Oh, I see. Okay. There's no one specific.
No.
I'm wondering, it's also an issue in, of course, the DSM system, but in the reformatting of the ICD-11, is there a role being played by somatic complaints and patterns of somatic symptoms that are associated with stress reactions ranging from acute stress to PTSD, since it's sort of focused on a global and cross-cultural perspective?
Okay. Who wants to respond? Let me try to respond. We were discussing this several or an extended time, and we were regarding it as unspecific. Although we all know that people of the stress response disorders often show the somatic symptoms. But it is also the case for depressive affective disorders and some other disorders. And therefore, in the sense or with the purpose of narrowing the diagnosis and and increasing the clinical utility, we decided against mentioning the somatic symptoms, knowing that they are often
accompanying the syndromes or diagnosis we just presented. Therefore, no, there is no mention, but I would say almost all of the disorders we presented today can come along with somatic symptoms. Is there any addition you want to? No, okay. Next question, please.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for these really informative talks across these two symposiums. Focusing on clinical utility seems to make a lot of sense. I know that others have other investments in diagnostic categories, including disability systems and coders, and there's other stakeholders that will consider these diagnoses, be using these diagnoses. Looking at the proposed PTSD diagnoses, I got to thinking about, well, as a clinician, if someone asked me whether these are great for clinical utility or not, I don't know, there might be a tendency to go with whatever gives me the most independence to treat and diagnose and consider my patients as I see fit. So I think you might get more thumbs up on less criteria. And I wonder how that's going to translate to accountability when you're thinking forensics or disability systems, et cetera. Those issues haven't been talked about in the symposiums. I wonder if someone would like to comment on that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What you are mentioning is very important, but I can tell you that the previous ICD-10 already had these functions, which you just described. They are for the insurance companies, for all kinds of legal purposes. The ICD-10 had to be used in many countries of the world, and it worked pretty well. Also, we know that there some improvements were needed. But I expect that the new version of ICD-11 will serve the same purposes for you mentioned pretty well. And probably, as Chris in his first presentation on PTSD showed us, by reducing the complexity, we may increase the reliability, which is really important for the counting for insurance purposes or legal purposes. And I hope that this narrowing down to the two hardcore definitions will help for these purposes. Who wants to add something? Or we got some other...
Your question about insurance was especially important for adjustment disorder. There was some pressure because of the non-specificity of this category for it to disappear. The problem is that it means that when life hurts and it impairs your functioning, then a lot of people would remain without insurance and without help if we normalize it. So there is a balance, a trade-off between non-over-medicalizing life hurts and it impairs our functioning while ensuring that people who in fact suffer from life events could get appropriate help and financial reimbursement. So that was an important discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. Other questions? Please use the microphone.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I'm constantly in a struggle with this issue of adjustment disorder. And maybe some of the clinicians can talk about it because it seems like the insurance companies and the managed care feel like they're pressuring us. If we just give an adjustment disorder diagnosis, it's like this constant pressure, like hurry up, shouldn't they be better now? Because it's just an adjustment disorder. And if it's just an adjustment disorder, how come they're not on medication? Like, it's been 6 months. So there's just this, you know, a lot of different clinical pressures.
Actually, what you are mentioning is was some of the ideas to work on this elaborated version of adjustment disorders. But
I mean, adjustment disorder is an interesting. There's a reason why it's the number 7 most used category, and I think that part of the reason is its stigma. I think it's historically for people treating patients is one of the, it's a least in psychotherapy, and you have to write down a diagnosis. It's always been widely that and dysthymia are the two acceptable diagnoses to write down. And it was like that for years. It wasn't until the managed care companies started causing accountability, somebody looked up the definition of adjustment disorder, saw that it can only last 6 months. So I think part of the pressure to stop using that code has to do with the reality that you can only use adjustment disorder longer than 6 months if the stressor is ongoing for longer than 6 months, which makes sense. If it's, in fact, a reaction to a stressful life event that should go away, if it hasn't gone away, it's probably the wrong diagnosis. So I think, not that I have anything positive to say about managed care, but in this context, they probably are justified in not allowing the adjustment disorder diagnosis to be used indefinitely. But I think it's an interesting problem with the struggle between trying to use a diagnostic code that's not stigmatizing and get paid. I mean, I think that's always been a problem, and I think that's NOS, in a way, it serves a similar function. And the insurance companies, I think, are still paying for that. And I think it is true that adjustment disorder does describe a circumscribed reaction. If it persists beyond 6 months, then the assumption is that there's some other problem going on, a personality disorder or dysthymia or chronic major depression or something.
But in the new criteria, you say 6 months, but it doesn't say it has to end. I mean, how did you phrase it?
I don't know. I believe the same rule would probably apply, that if the stressor is on, it's the same kind of idea. If you break up a romantic relationship and it's over, and 6 months later you're still stuck on it, you probably don't have an adjustment disorder anymore. It's probably something different. But if you're divorced, if you're going through a divorce, the thing's dragging on for 2 years and you're still preoccupied with it, then it's probably appropriate to call it adjustment disorder because you're having ongoing trouble
exactly.
adjusting to an
ongoing
stressor.
Exactly, and that's a lot of my adjustment disorders are prolonged, complicated divorcees
that
are just so distraught
by the
process. Yeah.
I think many stressors are chronic. I mean, you know, job loss is another good one. You get fired, but then you're unemployed indefinitely, and then that becomes a chronic stressor. So I think the six-month time frame has to do with the idea that if it's an acute stressor where the stressor has ended, presumably the clock starts ticking at the stressor end, and then you should have recovered by 6 months. But I think any stressor that is by very nature chronic, whether it's spousal abuse, we could name a million of them, but as long as the stressor is ongoing, it is appropriate to use adjustment disorder. And if the managed care company goes after you, you could point that out, that in fact chronic adjustment disorder is an accepted concept.
That's okay. Good. I like
one
that.
One closing remark is our diagnostic proposals are for worldwide use, but in particular, with the adjustment disorders proposal, we want to promote research on it. And if it's more research, then probably some of the problems will be resolved. But Bertolt is next, and already some others are interested in questions.
Okay. Well, thank you, Andreas. And thanks for the interesting presentations. I have some thoughts about what I like very much is that in DSM we are so narrow-minded within our psychological field. And with ICD, I feel some more space in it, but I also miss some of the space. And to tell you that DSM, the D is from disorder, and in ICD, the D is from disease. And that is a very different thing. A disorder or a disease is something which feels very different. You're much more frightened when someone says you have a disease than you have a disorder. And so the system of the ICD, and also the World Health Organization, wants to lower the burden of disease, which is not in the so much in the goal of the DSM. And for when you talk about the adjustment disorders, you have also this system within the WHO for primary care, for the classification of primary care. And that is because GPs, they don't diagnose diseases. They diagnose temporary disturbances. So I was, my question is, did you think about this structure of WHO for the whole health field about disease? Because when, for myself, when I started working in the trauma field in 1980, it was then the DSM was the first time that you had PTSD, and I didn't know anything about it. I only knew about severe stress reaction, concentration camp syndromes. And then with the police officer, I found that, the problem they couldn't solve themselves. So it was a sort of disease which didn't stop. And now I see such a enormous range of all kind of descriptions who want to recognize really important states of people and trying to help them, but it's also blurring in some way, I'm sorry to say, so I hope you have some solutions to this.
I may not have, never have, final answers to what you are saying. I think our work in progress equates disorder, disease, and condition. And probably we are, hopefully we are wise to do this, to equate it. And you know, as Michael in his very first presentation today showed us that, I miss a point. He had a good point about only the psychiatric chapter had definitions, narrative mm-hmm. definitions, and all the other subjects in medicine had not so far. And I still think if we are flexible enough to think that we are covering the best available knowledge at state-of-the-art knowledge for the system, we will not prevent other developments. And I can assure you, we very, very, very much have in the focus what's going on with the frontline providers. And people from your country, I learned Netherlands, are doing remarkably jobs across the world in some leading world health organizations other than WHO to provide this frontline support. And they are very much questioned what we are doing. And, you know, you could imagine all what we decided so far went through a very, very strict process of them questioning us if it is applicable in frontline services. Therefore, I don't have a final answer. Michael, you probably would like to address.
Two comments to that question. Well, first of all, the disorder disease thing has to do with the fact, at least in English and in the DSM too, the word disease usually means that we know the etiology. So the DSM has gone out of its way to avoid the word disease because mm-hmm. the word disorder is this thing, entity, that means, well, somebody's sick and it's a collection of symptoms, but we don't know the cause. So that's why, now the ICD historically is because it covers all of medicine, that's why it has the word disease in the title, where the DSM has avoided the word disease at all costs and uses the word disorder. So I think there's that. The other point I wanted to make is, which is I didn't really get to talk about it in the introduction, is there's another version of, we keep talking about this book being ready for use by frontline clinicians around the world. It's still incredibly complicated, I think, for a general practitioner to use mm-hmm. this system, and WHO is aware of that. And for that reason, there's a primary care version of the ICD-11, which mm-hmm. is being developed in tandem with this version. I think you talked about the number of categories that people like, and there's still going to be 200 or something categories in the mental disorder chapter, but in the primary care version, there's only going to be 28 categories. So I think the recognition of a simpler system, there's no way a general practitioner would ever use the mental disorder chapter. It's just way too complicated. Thank you. I think in recognition of that, WHO is actually giving high priority to the development of this primary care version. And I can't remember what the deal is with stress. I think there's a category for disorders due to stress in that one.
It may be that for this frontline services, what we talked about in the two symposia will come to one stress-associated disorder for the practitioners. Brigitte.
Yeah, first of all, thanks a lot for all this really appreciable work you're doing. It's just amazing. But I do have some concerns. One concern is that in one hand you made the world of stress-related disorders really easy by compiling smaller lists of symptoms. But on the other hand, you brought in quite a lot of categories of disorders, much more than we had beforehand. And thinking to my students, or also thinking to what I do as a psychosocial first aid leader in one of the major cities in Europe, I thought, okay, how to teach them? How to make them apply these different categories, like somebody working in a refugee camp with a torture survivor. What is the real PTSD that he or she should apply for this person in front of him coming from, I don't know, Afghanistan or Iraq? And he's not a soldier, he's not in the VA, he's in a Middle European refugee camp. So this is my concern. What is it about, and how to teach this to all these frontline workers that we have in the German-speaking countries, and they are elaborated. And there is one further remark in the acute stress reaction part, which you don't call a disorder, and I'm happy about this because I've seen hundreds of people with stress reactions. And my remark is going to those people who have a late onset of stress reaction. Don't forget those people, because they are quite a lot. They function well within the first 48 hours, and after this they have maybe a week, maybe 10 days, where everything is under irritation, and we should take care about these people, and if they are in the ICD 11, then we have a greater chance to do it. So, sharing concerns, but also appreciation for what you initiated.
Thank you very much. I think your second question is really interesting, and we probably have to go back to our definition of acute stress reaction if it covers these late service users, I would call it, because the Z code now is for service use, and we should of course cover these late service users. But we probably, and as we showed you, ASR is no longer a diagnosis. With the other concern, I would say the first one, with the more differentiated approach, linking it back to what Bertolt just said, the current proposal is flexible. Is flexible also for teaching reasons. We did not talk about kind of an artificial concept, but Michael showed it at his slide, and I would have shown it again, that the two diagnoses, PTSD and complex PTSD, grouped together as traumatic stress disorders. And you know, and I'd already answered towards Bertolt that people from frontline in developing countries told us, yeah, we only have time to teach about stress-related disorders altogether, and therefore there is flexible possibility, and we have it in, we keep it always in mind. And for example, I can show you, I can tell you on another level of argument that, of course, the members of developing countries in our working group are not as research mental health professionals, but they are teaching it in their countries. They are teaching professors, and they keep it in mind.
Yeah. So I'd need to add a kind of extension of my concern. I was also thinking about DSM PTSD, and this confuses me, and it will confuse people. What is the real PTSD? Is it the DSM PTSD? Is it the ICD PTSD? Is it the complex PTSD in ICD? And this really scares me because I don't know what to apply. And this I was relating to this. I was aiming for this concern. But I know that's a very sophisticated.
Yeah, it's acknowledged. I would say it's really confusing. If I have often a schema on my presentations here that they have it as a broad concept which is covering what we call PTSD and complex PTSD. And it's controversy, and it may be of some confusion, but we did not find a better way so far. There's a next question, please.
I'm Misari Oe from Japan. My question is about complex PTSD to Marilyn. If ICD-11 begins, do you predict the decrease of the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder and increase of complex PTSD disorder, the diagnosis?
No, I don't, because I think it's very clear that borderline personality disorder is very distinct. And I didn't really get time to describe the data, but it's very clear that you have the complex PTSD and the PTSD individuals. And there is a third group that's very identifiable, which is borderline personality disorder with PTSD symptoms or sometimes with fully comorbid symptoms. And, you know, it is my clinical opinion, and I'm looking at some data, that what distinguishes complex PTSD from borderline personality disorder in terms of all of the borderline personality characteristics is that those with BPD, those core symptoms, are feelings of abandonment, sense of emptiness, and tendency to self-injure or to make suicide attempts when experiencing perceived abandonment. That those three characteristics are much, much higher. About 80% of people with borderline personality disorder endorse those, while people with complex PTSD, it's very low, between 20% and lower. So I think that's a big difference between the two groups, and I think it also has strong clinical implications because with borderline personality disorder, it's very hard to do short-term therapy. In fact, I think it's contraindicated when you end a therapy at 6 months, even if you've said therapy is going to end from day one. It is a disorder where people become very needy or attached, or the process of therapy is really about building an internal object sense of self. And that can't be done in 6 months. And when you end therapy, that emptiness comes to the fore. There's relapse, self-injurious behavior, suicide attempts. And
I have one more question about according to complex PTSD. My personal impression shows that this definition of complex PTSD is that not the same the name of complex PTSD before in the consensus of the historical meaning. So my impression, this definition shows not the name of complexity, but the severity of symptoms of PTSD, because the PTSD showed three main symptoms, and complex PTSD showed more symptoms. So my impression is not complex, but severe PTSD. So this is my comment.
I think when you do latent profile analyses, you can distinguish between severity and different classes. And usually what you see, if it's just a difference in severity, is that the shape of the lines is parallel. But what you see when you have different classes is a completely different profile, literally. And what these analyses showed was that there were the PTSD symptoms. Then one group went much higher, you know, in terms of the self-disturbances, while the other group went much lower. And that's generally taken as a qualitative difference as opposed to a quantitative difference.
Okay.
excuse me, we may have to close here. And I thank you very much for your ongoing interest. With the first symposium, we were right over our time frame. Now we are right in time. My last remark is that, as already introduced, here are some leaflets which have a direct access code to the internet, and you don't have to use then the way contacting this Spencer Evans. Who is interested, please take one of the copy. It will be here, and the rest will go out on this public table. Thank you very much for this, for your patience. Thank you very much.